This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's Wednesday, May 8th, when the defense wants a mistrial because of you. You know you've struck a nerve. We start here. Stormy Daniels takes the stand against former President Trump.
They were a bit gross.
For all the details of a lewd liaison, how much damage did this do? President Biden makes a plea on behalf of American Jews.
There is no place on any campus in America, any place in America, for anti-Semitism or hate speech or threats of violence of any kind.
As Israel begins its incursion into Rafah, the U.S. has taken a dramatic step in response, and TikTok claps back.
This has become an issue of nationalism and patriotism as well. They're not going to let go of this easily.
Why the social media company says it can't be sold even if it wanted to. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. At the heart of the case, the people of New York versus Donald Trump, is a story that Trump never wanted out there. Remember, in the weeks leading into the 2016 presidential election, an old outtake from Access Hollywood had emerged.
I gotta use some Tic Tacs just in case they start kissing her.
This graphic conversation, recorded in 2005 and obtained by the Washington Post, captures Trump bragging about sexually assaulting women.
Grab him by the I can do anything.
This became a campaign crisis that October. Trump was deemed toxic to women, to values voters. Republican lawmakers were begging him to drop out of the race.
I've said and done things I regret, and the words released today on this more than a decade-old video are one of them.
As all this was unfolding, behind the scenes, another story is being floated to tabloids, a story that Trump at one time had a sexual encounter with a porn star, an actress going by the name of Stormy Daniels. Daniels ended up getting $130,000 to not say anything about this. No one's denying a payment was made to silence her story, but only two people really know if that story was true to begin with. Yesterday, one of them was at the defense table, accused of falsifying election finance documents, while the other was called to the stand. This testimony from Stormy Daniels was not just compelling, it was graphic, it was intimate, it was undoubtedly embarrassing, and it could have profound implications for this case. Let's start today with ABC's chief legal analyst, Dan Abrams. And Dan, this testimony was shocking, like to the point where I feel like we should warn people that this was allegedly a consensual affair, but I'm just saying, like, if you get grossed out easily or you got kids in the car or something, you can skip ahead a couple minutes. What was alleged here by Stormy Daniels?
So we got a lot of details about what Stormy Daniels says happened between her and Donald Trump, about the pajamas that he was wearing, about exactly what he said to her about the sex, what he said afterwards. You know, they were a bit gross, but it was the heart of what led to all of this. And so the reason there was this call for a mistrial, in part, was the amount of detail that she provided, information that the defense team believes is both unnecessary and incredibly prejudicial to Donald Trump.
Like, they're asking if he was wearing a condom, right? Like, it went, yeah. Everything was part of this.
Right. Brad, I didn't know how far you'd want me to go on this. So, yes, they were. That was part of what they were talking about, is him not wearing a condom. So that's the kind of detail that they were talking about. You know, what position the sex was in. And so the explanation from the prosecutors would be that the details just show you how credible she is when she describes exactly what the room looked like,
right,
what he said, a playful moment that they had where he has a magazine with himself on the cover and she says she's going to spank him with it, and she does. Mm. So it was incredibly interesting, but one could argue, not that relevant to the fundamental questions as legal matters in the case.
Wait, that's the issue, right? Because it's like, he's not being charged with having an affair. He's not even being charged with making a hush money payment. Those aren't illegal. He's being charged with falsifying documents about the hush money. So why does anyone even need to hear about the alleged encounter?
Right. I'd say for two reasons. First of all, because if he was doing it to impact the election is one of the critical questions. And, you know, the timing of all of this, she's involved in the negotiation, right? She isn't just there for the sex. She's also there as part of the negotiation for the money. And so that's relevant. I think there's a second factor here, and that is that Donald Trump is denying it even happened. If Donald Trump had conceded, yes, we had sex, it was consensual, I shouldn't have done it, it was a mistake, I think at that point there would have been an argument to say, do we really need her to testify about the sex? But because Donald Trump is denying it, I think it becomes more relevant in the context of the case. And so,
like a credibility thing?
Well, but just also because the prosecution is laying the foundation for the circumstances surrounding the negotiation. And knowing whether it happened or not is a relevant factor. Meaning, if you believe it did not happen, right? If there's nothing to suggest that this ever happened, the negotiation over the money, I think, becomes a little bit different. Now, the Trump team may say it shouldn't matter, right? It was a payoff that he shouldn't have had to make regardless. He made it because this was a nuisance, they would say. But when the circumstances surrounding the negotiation are so relevant in terms of his motivations, was it to try to impact the election? Was it to try to keep this information out because it was so close to the election? I do think that detail becomes that much more important.
So after Stormy Daniels gives her direct examination, the defense comes up and is like, you got to issue a mistrial. Like, this jury is tainted from here on out. The judge basically said, no, that's what cross-examination is for. So, I mean, how did the defense handle cross? It sounded like they were trying to essentially to undermine any credibility she had at all.
Well, look, I think that there is a legitimate argument that she went too far in terms of some of what she was testifying about. And I think the judge even recognized that, right? He was saying, oh, you know, I wish she hadn't said some of what she said. But, you know, that happens in trials. So on cross-examination, the defense is trying to show that she really hates Donald Trump and that she'll say anything to get Donald Trump convicted here. And she admitted that she hates Donald Trump, but when asked, and so, you know, you want to see him go to jail, don't you? She got, you know, she recognized the trap that was being set and basically responded that if the jury finds him guilty, you know, that's the issue. So there was a couching of her answers. Yes, she admitted that she is animus towards Donald Trump, but didn't go as far as to say, and yes, I'm going to say anything that will get him convicted, because she's saying, I'm just telling the truth. I'm just telling my story.
Really interesting. And again, we look at all these cases on the horizon. None of the other ones are going to trial anytime soon. In fact, when you look about the case about the handling of classified documents by former President Trump, a federal judge just delayed that trial indefinitely. So stakes couldn't be higher here in New York. Dan Abrams, thank you so much.
Sure.
Next up on Start Here, Israel makes the move into Rafah. So is that a fork in the road for the U.S.? We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
People who disappear without a trace.
Where is she?
The most notorious murder cases in New York.
Pure evil.
And the most devious killers.
There's a Hannibal Lecter feel to him.
For chilling true crime stories, follow the True Crime NYC podcast wherever you listen.
For the last several weeks, Israel has been ominously warning of a military operation in Rafah, in the southern part of Gaza. Israel says it would start taking land there, clearing out any people or infrastructure used by Hamas. Well, yesterday, that incursion seemed to begin. Israeli troops began moving into Rafah, just past the border checkpoint for now. Remember, lots of Americans have begged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to do this, including President Biden himself.
Without a credible plan for ensuring the safety and support of more than 1 million people sheltering there.
But on the same day yesterday, it was Holocaust Remembrance Day, which led to Biden giving a forceful speech on anti-Semitism at what's also become an inflection point for the world's only Jewish state. ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman joins us. Matt, first off, Rafah, what does this military operation look like at this moment?
I think compared to the start of the war, this appears to be limited, right? This is not the shock and awe. This is not a massive bombardment of Gaza City that we've seen. It's not the even surrounding of Khan Yunis, which is the second largest Palestinian city that we saw a couple of months back. This seems to be more of a pinpoint strike. Launched from the Kerem Shalom area, which was this major border crossing through which most of the aid was getting into Gaza, which Hamas over the past couple of days has shelled. It was shut down. Israel pushed right up against the border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. That is an absolutely critical lifeline as well. There are airstrikes in Rafah. We hear that there are dozens of people who are killed, scores who've been wounded so far.
Our understanding is that this was a very limited operation designed to cut off Hamas's ability to smuggle more weapons and funding into Gaza.
But this is not the big push that I think the U.S. has been worried about and that Israel has telegraphed for the past couple of months, one that would require mass evacuation of well over a million Palestinians from the very southern part of Gaza, more to the center and the west of it.
Yeah, and we've been told some evacuations have begun, but again, so many people there that you'd imagine that would take days or weeks. What is the reaction from the U.S. government as far as this new sort of move in towards Rafah?
They're not happy about it, and they're not shy about making it known at this point.
We don't support ground operations in Rafah that would put the majority or even any of the civilians there at any greater risk.
They have been saying for months now that Rafah is a bad idea. They have also been saying that they have not been presented with plans that they believe are sufficient for protecting the 1.5 million Palestinians who are living in that enclave. They assume that anywhere between 800,000 and 1.2 million would evacuate. Israel says it has these evacuation plans. It says it's setting up these humanitarian islands with food and water and toilets and hospital tents. But apparently the U.S. says this is not sufficient. And we are seeing for the first time a very material reaction from the United States. This is not just the president lashing out, saying that Israel needs to do more to protect civilians, to get more humanitarian aid into Gaza. The U.S. is hitting Israel where it hurts most. We understand that the NSC directed the U.S. Air Force not to deliver and to suspend the delivery of certain munitions to Israel. And this is something that very senior Israeli officials told me just a couple of months back would never happen, that wow. The U.S. would never prevent the delivery of critical munitions to Israel in a time of war, in an election year. They thought that that would be anathema, but it's happening, Brad, and it's happening right now.
Wow, right. Huge inflection point with a war with, 34,000 reported dead in Gaza, still more than 100 hostages held in Gaza. And, I mean, regardless of what you think about Israel and this conflict right now, doesn't negate the fact that anti-Semitic incidents in this country are still on the rise. Matt, Biden made this address yesterday. What were the takeaways from these remarks on a day of Holocaust remembrance?
You know, it's said in Israel and in the U.S. that Biden is arguably the best friend that Israel and the Jews have ever had. He warmly embraced Netanyahu just a couple of days after the war. He continued that embrace by flooding Israel with munitions. And then in the months after that, giving Israel political and diplomatic cover in the UN, all across Europe, in the world, and in the US. And now he's enveloping the Jewish people in this warm embrace as well, identifying with them, saying that anti-Semitism is never okay.
But there is no place on any campus in America, any place in America, for anti-Semitism or hate speech or threats of violence of any kind.
And of course, again, on the same day that they suspended munition deliveries to Israel, President Biden saying that Israel has a right to exist, that it's important, and that the U.S. is committed to its security.
Too many people denying, downplaying, rationalizing, ignoring the horrors of the Holocaust. And October 7th, including Hamas's appalling use of sexual violence to torture and terrorize Jews.
And there's no doubt that President Biden is speaking to many Jews who are concerned right now.
We've seen a ferocious surge of anti-Semitism in America and around the world. Vicious propaganda on social media. Jews forced to keep their hides or keepers under baseball hats, tuck their Jewish stars into their shirts.
Whether they support Israel's policies or not, I think that there's palpable fear in many Jewish communities across the U.S. who are seeing and experiencing viscerally firsthand the skyrocketing of anti-Semitic incidents in this country.
Right. You could tell how firmly Biden believed this is really a scourge that is kind of overtaking the country right now. At the same time, we should also mention more than 8,000 reports of discrimination and hate crimes against Muslims last year. That's the highest we've seen in more than a decade as well. So just so much tension and distrust right now. Matt Gutman, our chief national correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
President Biden has already signed the law that forces TikTok's parent company to sell the app or face a ban in the U.S. Remember, ByteDance, that parent company, is based in China. Yeah, the country that can force any company within its borders to hand over any data the government wants and effectively co-opt your company into becoming a state enterprise.
I can think of a few better or easier ways to spy on American citizens or manipulate American public opinion than to make use of a popular app that is used by over 100 million Americans.
Well, this bill in the U.S. is now law. The only thing that would derail it is if it's rescinded or deemed illegal by the courts. Well, yesterday, TikTok sued the U.S. government over this. ABC senior White House correspondent Selena Wang has been covering it all. Selena, what is the issue from TikTok's eyes here? What is the argument?
Yeah, well, first, Brad, we knew that this was coming. TikTok has been vowing now that they are going to fight this as hard as they can in the courts. And TikTok argues that this is not going to work because this violates users' First Amendment rights, that it tramples over your right to free speech. And on top of that, they say it's actually not possible to sell off its U.S. operations. They say it's not possible commercially, technologically, or legally. So they argue in this lawsuit that this law essentially will force a shutdown of TikTok. And I can walk you through each one of those various challenges. So first of all, TikTok argues that if you make a standalone U.S. platform that is not part of this global app, it's not going to work because all of this is globally integrated. So a divestment means that you can't get this international content seamlessly available to U.S. viewers and vice versa. Now, secondly, TikTok says this is very complicated coding we're talking about here, and that the code base that underpins the app would have to be separated to a new team of engineers. And they argue it would take years for this new set of engineers to just understand the source code and do their job. And they say to then keep the app functioning, the engineers would need access to ByteDance software, which the law bans. On top of that, they make an argument about how the Chinese government has made clear it would not allow a divestment.
Yeah, and Selena, I mean, you reported out of China for years, right? You were based in Beijing. Is that legit? Like the China angle of they would never allow this to be sold? Do you get the sense that is a real thing that they would say, we'll forgo the American audience rather than let ByteDance sell this to a different company?
Yeah, well, the Chinese government, Brad, has made clear that they do not want this app to be sold. In fact, back when Trump tried to ban TikTok, the Chinese government actually changed their own laws that would prohibit the sale of sensitive technologies like the algorithm that underpins TikTok. So that algorithm is the reason why TikTok is so powerful. Why it's so popular and sticky and addictive is because of that algorithm. And so if you sell the app without that algorithm, you're basically just selling a shell. It's not going to be powerful.
Right.
And for the Chinese government, this is more than just, you know, an app with fun videos. They are framing this this as another example of the U.S. trying to suppress China's rise, trying to suppress China's technological ability. So this has become an issue of nationalism and patriotism as well. They're not going to let go of this easily.
But that's interesting, Selena. Doesn't that undercut that? If TikTok is saying, hey, this is all about First Amendment, man. Like, you can't do this. We're just a private company trying to do our thing. By the way, China won't let us. Doesn't that bolster the idea from the U.S. that this is a national security issue then?
Yeah, and actually, TikTok has done a number of things that sort of come back to bite them, including trying to mobilize all of the young people who use the app.
If you have a story about how TikTok impacts your life, we'll love for you to share it to showcase exactly what we're fighting for.
Which made lawmakers think, wow, this is a really powerful app. Mm. Look what the Chinese government could possibly do with this huge, influential network.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling the office of Congressman Ron Estes. How can I help you?
Hello. I got a notification on my phone that I heard that you guys are trying to ban TikTok.
No, so TikTok is intentionally misleading you.
Not to mention, Brad, as well, that this is hypocritical on the part of the Chinese government. Mm. China has essentially banned every single major foreign social media app. Think about Google, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, TikTok even is banned within China's borders. So to simply do my job when I was based in China, I had to use a virtual private network or VPN to get around China's internet firewall.
Well, and hypocritical from China. TikTok also says it's hypocritical of Joe Biden, considering his campaign uses TikTok that they say is so damaging here. Selena, what are the next steps then? Like, if you're trying to sell it, how does that work? Or, you know, and how does this lawsuit affect everything?
Yeah, exactly. So to avoid this ban, if TikTok can find a buyer, a U.S. buyer, well, then they can avoid all of this. But sources have been telling me that it would be very, very hard to find a buyer that could actually afford TikTok and complete this transaction within a year. In fact, some sources have told me that it's more likely TikTok will try and go public than be sold because the executives and investors of TikTok believe that there's no one in the market who can afford to buy TikTok at a fair price. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars, potentially even more than $100 billion.
Wow.
This is an incredibly expensive proposition.
Unbelievable numbers when you're talking about that. And so if it goes public, then all of us can own TikTok, including consumers in China and any other country. All right, Selena Wang, thank you so much.
You got it, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, somebody's fruit salad is about to get a serious glow up. Welcome to Pineapple Excess. One last thing is next.
Married moms in the suburbs. They've been called soccer moms. They've been called security moms.
Pamela Wilk is a so-called soccer mom.
Those so-called Walmart moms.
She calls herself a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms.
The hockey mom trying to connect with the soccer moms.
In the 1990s, the idea of soccer moms as the quintessential swing voter took hold. Elections could be won or lost based on a candidate's ability to appeal to them. But were quote-unquote soccer moms actually the deciding factor? In a new series on the 538 Politics podcast, we take a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from, and does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. What's the most you'll pay for good fruit? Like, when I'm at the grocery store, I'm hunting for sales on strawberries, but put me at a farmer's market, and suddenly I'm like, oh, $8 sounds reasonable. They're organic, right? Well, a few days ago, Del Monte, the agriculture behemoth, announced the arrival of a new type of pineapple called the Ruby Glow. It's red on the outside, lush and yellow on the inside, and it costs nearly $400.
A beautiful red exterior and yellow interior. It's really a special fruit.
I'm not making this up. This is a regular pineapple created in Costa Rica. Its sole U.S. distributor, Melissa's Produce, says it's smooth, not too stringy, very low in acidity. It also comes in a fancy box. And in some ways, this is a return to form for the pineapple. Back in the day, they were way more expensive. When Christopher Columbus brought some of the first pineapples back to Europe, people went mad for them. They were so rare and coveted that aristocrats would pay the modern-day equivalent of $8,000 for them. In England, people would even rent a pineapple to put on the table for a fancy party. You didn't eat it, God no, you just rented it, you gave it back, then you'd see it slightly more rotten at your neighbor's party next week. Some people rented pineapples to carry around, like Rent the Runway for tropical fruit. The thing that's changed, of course, is we now have an agricultural system and global supply chain that can ship cheap fruit anywhere. What hasn't changed is the fact that traders want to make money and that wealthy folks will pay almost anything for the next novelty item.
Not only does it look beautiful, it tastes beautiful.
In recent years, Del Monte has cultivated new pineapple varieties like the Pink Glow with flesh that's bright pink. But forget pineapples even. Researchers at the University of Arkansas created a thornless blackberry, and last year, UC Riverside debuted the new Luna avocado, which was specifically bred to grow off smaller trees and to ship more easily. It's a reminder that nearly every piece of produce you eat is the result of careful cultivation, and that centuries later, the IP on new ones is still worth a windfall. There's also, in the last couple of years, this new kind of mini pineapple named the Honey Glow, which can be easily carried in one hand. It's $12, and then it's $30 extra to ship. Like, I gotta figure out how to cut one of these things more reliably before I go, like, investing in them. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Married moms in the suburbs. They've been called soccer moms. They've been called security moms.
Pamela Wilk is a so-called soccer mom.
Those so-called Walmart moms.
She calls herself a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms.
The hockey mom trying to connect with the soccer moms.
In the 1990s, the idea of soccer moms as the quintessential swing voter took hold. Elections could be won or lost based on a candidate's ability to appeal to them. But were quote-unquote soccer moms actually the deciding factor? In a new series on the 538 Politics podcast, we take a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from, and does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts.